Parthaya Pratibodhitam Bhagavata Narayanena Swayam Vyasena Kratitam Purana Munina Madhye Mahabharatam Advaitamrita Varshinim Bhagavatim Ashtadashadhyayinim Ambatvamanusantatami Bhagavad Gita Bhagavad Vishnu. Let's do 36 and 37. We're really moving into 37, but since 36 and 37 in Swamiji's Gita Home Study are together, we'll just take these two verses together and put more emphasis on 37 at this time. It's a set. The Sattva, Rajas, and Tamas of the Sukha. Okay. Oh, that door's not open.
No, Edward just opened it.
The door into...
But there's a strange man in there.
It's just incredible. I mean, he went, opened the door, and Tibby wasn't even in the house. The moment he opened the door, she came in.
It's a guard cat.
Yeah. Right. Sukham Twidanim Trividam Sukham Twidanim Trividam Shrinu Me Paratarshaba Shrinu Me Paratarshaba Abhyasat Ramate Yatra Abhyasat Ramate Yatra Dukantam Cha Nigachati Dukantam Cha Nigachati Yataragre Vishamiva Yataragre Vishamiva Pariname Mritopamam Pariname Mritopamam Tetsukam Satvikam Proktam Tetsukam Satvikam Proktam Atma Buddhi Prasadajam Atma Buddhi Prasadajam. Okay, in this section, we're looking at the three gunas in reference to sukha. So sattvika sukha, rajasa sukha, and tamasa sukha. Okay. Sukha means ananda or happiness. You know. So here he says, sukham to idanim trividam shrinu me bharatarshaba abhyasat ramate yatra dukantam cha nikachati. He says, now, when he says this, to idanim, to means now, whereas we're moving on from the last one. We're moving on to a new grouping, the Sattva, Rajas, and Tamas of Sukha. So idanim means now, to differentiates it from what we've been doing before. So he says, sukham to idanim, trividam shrinu me bharatarshaba. A bharatarshaba means most exalted among the Bharata clan. So Arjuna is considered one of the most exalted among the Bharatas. So he says, Shrinume, listen to me, listen to what I have to say here about this trividam, this threefold sukha. By threefold sukha, because in this section we're talking about the three gunas, sattva, rajas, and tamas, so by trividam, these three different types of sukha, sattvika, rajasa, tamasa. This first verse is, after introducing it with this line, he's now going to start talking about the sattvika sukha. So he says, for sattvika, he starts like this. Abhyasat ramate yatra dukantam cha nigachati. He says, in which sukha, where, yatra means where, means in which sukha, one revels in that abhyasat, from repetition. Abhyasa means a repeated practice. It's a spiritual term, really. When I'm doing abhyasa, means I'm continually practicing something. Like, say, in Vedic chanting, I'm doing abhyasa of those mantras over and over and over and over again. But for a mamukshu, the abhyasa is shravana, manana, nididhyasana. Means until I gain jnana nishtha, until I gain rootedness, really clarity in this knowledge, I keep exposing myself to it, right? The shravana, manana, nididhyasana, in fact, becomes a way of life. For the mumukshu, what is primary to me is exposing myself to the teaching, getting clarity in terms of what the teaching says, exposing myself to the pramana. Manana is questioning it. Why couldn't it be this way? Why does the Shastra say it's this way? Why couldn't it be this way? So clearing all of the doubts. First, it's understanding. It's seeing what the Shastra is saying. Then clearing the doubts, manana, to why it might not be that way. Why couldn't it be like this? Instead of how the Shastra says, that's manana. And nididhyasana is that process, contemplative process, of allowing my mind to spend time with myself, resolving my mind into the Atma, into the Self, resolving the mind into my knowledge. That's a good way to say it. Because it's not just nididhyasana is recognizing, if you think about nididhyasana, contemplation, for us in Vedanta, contemplation is allowing the mind to own up and to deeply abide in what I see at the time of teaching. So we could say nididhyasana is a contemplation upon my knowledge, what I've understood at the time of teaching. What I've understood at the time of teaching really is the Mahavakya. If we use for the Mahavakya Tetvamasi, or if I translate that in another way, that thou art, you are Ishwara. If I say you are Ishwara, there's a lot to understand there. That if I say I, this person here, is Ishwara. Mm-hmm. To understand that, I have to know what the jiva is. I have to recognize the Atma, the self of the jiva. I have to recognize what Ishwara is. I have to recognize what is the truth of Ishwara. So the whole knowledge is there. So what I mean, why I'm saying this now, is because when we do nididhyasana, the nididhyasana can be not just I am Brahman, I am the Satchidatma, where I'm just resolving my mind into conscious being. Nididhyasana also is saying I am the whole. I am Ishwara, where I'm resolving. If I say I am Ishwara, there's two things that are happening there. One is that I recognize the infinite non-dual nature of myself. The other, but I can look at it from different aspects, I can realize that this self that I am is the one non-dual self of Ishwara, the Maya Upadi, the one non-dual truth of the Maya Upadi, and bringing in the Maya Upadi, the whole manifest creation, bringing in that whole manifest creation, I recognize that this whole manifest creation is nothing but my being. That this whole is me. That the conscious being, which I am, which from the standpoint of this body, mind, sense organs is called the Atma, my own self, I recognize that this my own self is non-dual, one without a second, is the self in all beings, is the very self of Ishwara. And so this self, being the self of Ishwara, and then Ishwara, the whole Maya Upadi, has for its being, because Mithya, has for its being only this one non-dual self is me. That is me. When I recognize this, where is the jiva? If there is one self, which is me, right? And this one self is the self of this whole Maya Upadi that we call Ishwara, right? The Atma Brahman. Acknowledging this manifest Maya is what we call Ishwara. So this one non-dual self, which is the self of this whole Maya Upadi, so this whole we call Ishwara, Brahman with the Maya Upadi is Ishwara. I recognize that I am that. When I recognize that, what happens to the jiva, to this body, mind, sense organs? Well, this body, mind, sense organs is part and parcel of Ishwara. It's like warp and woof. It's like if you have a dream or imagination, so if you have a daydream, even if you have a daydream, the jivas, even the jiva, the individual that you happen to be identified with, if you are identified with anyone, if you're identified with somebody in that daydream, that daydream, that jiva, that individuality, has no separation whatsoever from Ishwara. It is part, it belongs to Ishwara. It's like one of Ishwara's limbs. It's part of Ishwara. If you were to take it out of Ishwara, you're going to rip a hole into Ishwara. It is only Ishwara. So this body, mind, sense organs, the whole jiva upadi, has no separation from Ishwara whatsoever. It's like if you have an imagination, the imagination is one entity. And within that imagination, so many different things are happening, right? But all of them are part of that whole story. And that whole story has you for itself. And so now, because until I gain knowledge, the Dehatma Buddhi means the identification of this, of my mind's identification of the Atma, of myself with this body, has beginningless lifetime supporting it. The whole creation supports it. Your sense organs support it. Your mind supports it. Because everything about this upadi, this body, mind, sense organs, is meant to participate in the world. All of your sense organs and all of your means of knowledge are to give me knowledge of this world, of this dual world. All of my organs of action, my hands and my feet, etc., my mouth, all of my organs of action are meant to participate in this world. And so now I become a mumukshu and I want to know, well, what is the truth of this whole thing? Who am I really? Am I bound by the samsara? By the constant birth and death, the constant change, the constant changing sukha dukkha of this world, is that all that I am? And so I've asked the question. Once I ask the question, the Shastra says, if you ask the question and you're serious about it, you ask the right question, and you really want to know that answer, at that time the Upanishads will find their way to you. The teacher will find its way to you. Once that question of what is really happening here and who am I, the real who am I question, then that knowledge finds its way to you. And as you listen to this knowledge as a mumukshu, you find your mind grapples with it and so much just resonates as true, but you have this doubt and you have that doubt. You work through all of these doubts, you gain more and more and more clarity, and at the same time you're still acting like you're this body, mind, sense organs, paving your own way in this world, looking for happiness. So Nididhyasana, what that does is give your mind some time to be with the reality that you've understood at the time of teaching. Not to be with something you don't understand, but to be with your knowledge that you have understood. To sit with it so that your mind has a chance to own up yourself. And so Nididhyasana is really your chance to sit. It's like Shravana slowed down. You know, going in a very slow pace. Say if it's a guided meditation, it's a very, very slow Shravana that allows your mind to just sit there and see and be with that. So the mind gets to know it, know yourself, so that the ahankara, the I notion that is normally identified with your body, mind, sense organs, has a chance to shift its position from the body, mind, sense organs to your own being. So the ahankara shifts from its identification with this, the jiva upadi, to its identification with yourself as Brahman and yourself as Ishwara. And then in terms of the meditation that we did today, this type of meditation gives my mind a chance with some sort of a sankalpa. Like if I say to Bhagawan, I want with what you want. Those aren't just silly words. Those are words where I have understood the difference between Ishwara Srishti and Jiva Srishti. I've seen the difference. I want to be here. I want to be present to what I have. I want to be present. It's like saying, I want to be present to Ishwara. I want this body, mind, sense organs to be part of Ishwara. But unless I retrain my mind, the mind very rarely is here as part of Ishvara, because it's used to running around with its own raga-dvesha, with its own likes and dislikes, and getting lost in its imaginal world. That's what it does. And so now I want to bring my mind home to my own swarupa, the Satchidananda swarupa of my being, the changelessness of my being, and to be present to Ishvara and let this body, mind, sense organs belong to Ishvara. So in the Prarabdha Karma, if I say in my own words, in the only way that you might say it, in your way, it's like saying, I want to be here with you, to Bhagavan. I want to participate with you. I want to be present here and to do what is here to be done, which is Dharma. What is to be done is Dharma. The Adharma comes about by Jiva Srishti. Adharma is born of Ajnanam. Adharma comes because I think I want this so that I can be happy and you're in my way. I want this so that I can be happy and you're taking up too much time. You're not making me happy. It's all projection. It's all Jiva Srishti. When I pull back the Jiva Srishti, then Dharma is what is natural. It's not natural to hate. It's natural to love. Even if you, when you think about your own, how to really think about this in terms of Dharma, when you think about how you want to be treated, you don't want to be hated. You want to be cared for. You want to be loved. You want to be respected. You want to be wanted. All beings want that. You want to, all of this. I want to be loved. It's very, very simple. And so if that's what is natural to you, it's what's natural to other beings. Right? And that's a natural way. It's natural for you to treat other beings in the way that you love to be treated, unless Jiva Srishti comes in. Jiva Srishti is born of Ajnanam. It's born of ignorance. Jiva Srishti, the projection of the jiva, the inner workings of the jiva, are born because of my projection of ananda or wholeness out onto the world. It doesn't never goes out to the whole world. It goes out to only particular things in the world. And its negative side of the coin is hatred. I want these things so that I can be happy. I want to get rid of these things so that I can be happy. It's all exactly, it's the same. It's all the same type of projection. You know? And so what is natural, if you're feeling angry or hateful or hurt, all of these negative spectrum of emotions, you know, we have to learn how to be with those on a deeper level by bringing my mind back to my knowledge. You know, treating others the way that I want to be treated. Giving people the benefit of the doubt. So many things that become just natural practices for me as I start reining in the raga dvesha, the likes and dislikes, which really are done from by removing this ajnanam. So what he says now, from this abhyasa, shravana manana nididhyasana, one revels in that, right? Where when one revels in that, shravana manana nididhyasana, and achieves an end, dukkantam, an end to suffering, reveling in their knowledge, shravana manana nididhyasana, we even say like this, as a mumukshu, you continue to stay in this knowledge doing shravana manana nididhyasana, and as a sannyasi, you continue to do shravana manana nididhyasana, though you might be the one who's teaching it. But still, that is your world, because jnanam is your world. Ignorance is not your world, right? And so everything that you experience is in reference to your knowledge. Just like for an ajnani, everything in their world is in reference to their ignorance. They might not know that because they won't think of themselves as self-ignorant, because they don't think about it. But once they think about it, then they'll recognize that. But for ajnani, everything is in reference to your knowledge. So abhyasa is continual. Sadhana is continual. Sadhana is continual whenever the sadhana is needed. The sadhana is needed whenever the jiva srishti is raising its head. Then there's a sadhana. There's something to look at. There's something to be with. There's something to hold. You know? So, where one revels in that abhyasa means the continual living in one's knowledge, and if not living in it, bringing it home, bringing your mind home to it. So that's the abhyasa. Either you're with it, that's your reality, or you're bringing your mind back to that reality through Shravana Manana Nididhyasana. And you attain an end to suffering. But now he says, in the second two lines, he says, and this sattvika sukha, which is this abhyasa, reveling in this abhyasa and bringing about a total end to dukkha, yet ted agre visham eva. He says, in the beginning, that abhyasa, that sattvika sukha, in the beginning is visham eva. It's like poison. It's just like poison, says. But pariname amrita upamam. In the end, when it transforms, as that transforms, it becomes amrita, like a beautiful heavenly nectar. Okay? In the beginning, it's poison, like that sattvika sukham. In the beginning, is like poison. And in the end, it's like the most beautiful nectar. And so what that means is that up until I become a mumukshu, you could say, I am distracting myself. I learn how to distract myself from myself. The mind becomes a master at distraction. I go after this, and then I go after that, and then I do this, and then I do that. Whatever I need to try to keep my mind engaged, to keep some sort of shanti happening, some sort of ananda happening. So my mind is distracted out here. It's busy. It's what we call vikshepa. It's always running out this, out here over this, or running here, running there. And if you don't have a place to run or a place to land, the mind is very uncomfortable. Right? It needs to have some home to land, somewhere to land. Otherwise it doesn't know what to do with itself. And so now, look at that situation. You have some sort of a solution as a samsari. You've developed escape routes, you know, things that you can do to bring some sort of sukha to yourself. Mm-hmm. Even though it's temporary, you have things worked out for yourself. How to distract yourself. How to make excuses. How to blame others, even. Something wrong, it's their fault. If I'm miserable, it's their fault. All excuses, all distractions. Once you become a mumukshu, because you've actually realized, if when you become a mumukshu, you've actually realized that no matter if it's somebody's fault or not anybody's fault, nothing is going to work. There is no possibility of the universe giving you what you really want because of the nature of the universe. It's the whole, everything in the universe is subject to continual change. There's nothing stable or lasting here. It's not possible for you to get what you really want. At some point, you recognize that. I can't get what I want. Okay, now I want to know the truth. I want to know myself. I go through this whole process. But now when I want to know myself and I've realized that all of these escapes and distractions aren't helping, now I'm ready to be with myself. But when I'm ready to be with myself, then there are layers upon layers of problems I have to confront. I have to confront all of my traumas, all of my unhappinesses, all of my feelings of incompleteness, all of my feelings of not being worthy, all of my feelings of inadequacy, all of my angers, all of my adharmas, all of my meanness, yeah. Everything. All of my trumps. There's no stone that's going to be left unturned. Every single thing, you know. all of the projections, all of the excuses, all of those, I have to be with them, and I have to learn how to be with them in a way that's transformative. That's why they say this parinama. Parinama means to change, to transform. So when all of this poison, you know, accumulated poison, when that is transformed, means as I do that work, then what is left is the most beautiful nectar. Because in the transformation of these poisons, of these adharmas, of these complexes, of these hurts, of these angers, of these hatreds, whatever it is that happens to be there, the pile that I've accrued for myself, as I go through all of these things and transform them, they're no longer problematic because I've done the work. They're no longer bothering me. When they're not bothering me, then what is left is just me, just my own being, with a mind that is not troubled. A mind that is not troubled, it's not that it's adding, I'm not looking for a mind that has a sukha-vritti or a dukkha-vritti. It's just a mind that is not troubled. A mind that is not troubled just naturally enjoys my own being. My being is not competing with a troubled mind. Right? I'm there whether the mind is troubled or not. I'm there, I'm self-evident, I'm not covered. But when the mind is troubled, the mind itself wants to cure that trouble. It's like when the body is sick or hurt, the normal inclination of living beings is to go and take care of that pain. Say your body is hurt. You have knowledge. And so you have knowledge, your body is hurt. You have self-knowledge. You have nishta. Body is hurt. What do you think happens? You think that the mind says, body is hurt, but I have nishta. Body is hurt, but I'm happy. Let it hurt. Is that at all what we do? When the body is hurt, we try to take care of it, to fix it. What do you think the mind does when the mind is hurt? The attention goes to the hurt, wants to fix it. If you have, as you gain knowledge, you also gain the means for fixing that mind in a way that is transformative. Until you have knowledge and have some dharma or a mind that's committed to dharma, the way you go about fixing that hurt can make the hurt much worse. Like say there's a hurt or a betrayal or something has happened that has caused you a great deal of pain. And so now you need to fix that hurt because every part of you will be wanting to fix that hurt. But now how are you going to fix it? You could drink it to death. You could drug it to death. You know? You could you could fight others who are responsible. Knock off the people who you think are responsible for causing the hurt. There's so many things. You're going to do something. That's what I'm saying. You're going to do something to try to solve that hurt in your mind. The hurt mind. It's not that you're going to do nothing. But the thing is that once you gain knowledge, you learn what to do in a way that fits with the universe, that's true to Ishwar, that's true to the way things are, that actually do help. And so as I take care of my mind, which is in a lot of pain, for whatever baggage I have, whatever amount of pain I have, that pain has to be dealt with, but I learn how to deal with it in a way that is transformative. That's the parinama. In a way that actually helps, that actually works. And then what am I left with as I'm resolving these hurts? I'm left with like the ananda of my own being that has always been there, but now is there minus the hurts. It's always been there in exactly the same way, but the hurts have been transformed. And so I now just naturally enjoy the ananda that has always been there and always will be there. Yananda that was even there amidst the hurts, but probably I didn't recognize it. It's not that that Ananda, that wholeness of my being, wasn't there. It was there. But the mind doesn't recognize it because it's totally engaged in resolving the hurt. Just like the body is engaged in healing the body, the mind is engaged in, you know. If I know, as a mumukshu, if I know how to solve this hurt, then also my knowledge is engaged. My knowledge is engaged. Because that becomes something I understand in terms of how to solve the hurt. See what I mean? The mind has to solve the hurt, but it's only going to solve the hurt in the way it knows how. So in light of this knowledge, I know a much different way of handling this hurt. And that way of handling the hurt involves Ishvara, it involves the Ananda of my own being, it involves inner child work, it involves so many different methodologies that I've understood in light of my knowledge, and I'm able to apply those things in order to solve these different levels of hurt that I have in my mind. And as I do that, this ultimate uttamam, this ultimate supreme nectar is what I am left with. And that's the nectar, not as a big bliss vritti, but as a very, my own being as I always am, but now without any of these pains. And so what they say then, that sattvika sukham, that starts with this visha, because you're not now distracting yourself with all kinds of excuses and raga dveshas, trying to fulfill raga dveshas. Those distractions you're not doing anymore. So now you're left to deal with your hurts and your pains. That's like poison. It's painful. But as those things transform, then that sattvika sukha is what is there. And he says, Atma Buddhi Prasadajam, and that sukha is born of the grace, the grace of knowledge of yourself. That's prasad. That's the prasad. That sukha is a prasad. In many, many ways, there's different ways to talk about this. The Atma Buddhi means knowledge of the self, means that the very source of sukha itself is recognized, and so the mind now has a home base. Because yourself is not away from the mind. And that knowledge also blesses the mind. See, it's one thing to say, so let's say it like this. Moksha, you know, what really is the moksha pala, the very fruit of moksha, is the recognition of my own being, self-knowledge, so that the self that I am is aparoksha, it's recognized to me, there's nothing that ever can take that away. And that ananda swarupa of myself is there recognized, no matter what the vrittis are. It doesn't make any difference. If I have a happy vritti, a sad vritti, an agitated vritti, it doesn't make any difference because all of those have no capacity to cover that amrita, that nectar of that fullness of my own being. Mm. That never changes at all. Once it's been differentiated, it never changes. But there's a prasad. There's a prasada that comes from that, that the mind enjoys. Because my being and the ananda, the amrita of my own being, is not covered by any vritti. It could be a dukkha vritti, it could be a sukha vritti, it doesn't cover me. But there's a prasad to that knowledge, and the prasad is that the buddhi that has that knowledge now enjoys itself, from its own standpoint, a shanta vritti. It enjoys peace from its own standpoint, much more of a absolute peace than ever could have imagined before, because for that mind, the problem has been solved. The problem has been solved because I have found the source of the ananda that I've spent all of these beginningless lifetimes searching for. Well, if I could just have this, I would be happy. If I could just have this, I'd be happy. No, well, I need this too. lifetimes and lifetimes and lifetimes trying to solve this problem of gaining the ananda that I know whenever I experience, I know that's how it's supposed to be, but it's elusive. It's always elusive because it's always projected out onto something else, out onto an object. And anything can happen to shift the dynamics of my relationship with that object. And so the sukha is so elusive. I experience this ananda, but it comes and goes. What happens when the mind discovers the changeless source of the atma, of the ananda, to be your very being, which is the very self of the mind? When the mind discovers that, that is freedom. Because that atma, that ananda, can never go anywhere. Nor can the mind ever get away from it. Say you send your mind to the moon, well, yourself is already there. There's nothing the mind can do to get away from the source of ananda. Nor can anybody ever take it away. How can anybody, even Ishwara can't take it away. It's the non-dual being of Ishwara. And so the mind, from its own standpoint, enjoys a sukha-vritti because it has recognized the content, the very source of the sukha. So it enjoys its own happiness as prasad. Mm. That's its prasad. But that's a secondary gain. A jnani doesn't need that prasad. I don't need my mind to be any particular way because my being is whole. The ananda of my being never comes and goes and never changes at all. If this dukkha vritti comes through or this vritti comes, it doesn't make any difference. Because it's just like the weather. It doesn't do anything to me. So that's the moksha. But there's a prasad there that the mind enjoys because the mind has found what it has always searched for, which is an ananda, a wholeness, a well-being that no one can ever take away, that I can never get away from, that nothing can happen to change. So that's what I call the secondary, Swamiji also, secondary gain. That's the prasada. It's a prasada buddhi, right? Primary gain is, I don't need that mind to be like that. It doesn't matter. But because it doesn't matter, the mind is like that. See what I mean? It has to be like that because it's not away from the source of ananda. But for the mind to get to that type of amrita, this uttama amrita, it has to work through its issues. To get the prasada, it has to work through its issues. Just as yourself, just your being. Once you really know yourself, you are there no matter what the mind is doing. But if the mind is still causing you too much pain, if you don't address that pain, the mind is going to figure out some way to address it itself. Because that is what's natural. It is natural to address pain. And so if you know, that's why as the sadhanas, if you know the means for addressing pain, you know, the sadhanas in reference to the Vedanta sadhanas for addressing the pain properly, it transforms. And it leaves the mind, you know, with some peace. And then it has that prasada of being able to revel, ramate in the first verse, that ramate, to revel in its knowledge, to revel in the self. That's the prasada buddhi from this knowledge. Moksha is the aparoksha jnana, the direct, immediate recognition of my own, the fullness of my own presence. Mm. So, okay, we'll do move on to 38 next time. Okay. Om Swasti Prajapyah Paripalintam Nyayena Margena Mahim Mahishaha Go Brahmane Bhyashubhamastu Nityam Loka Samasta Sukhino Bhavantu Kale Varshatu Parajanyah Prithivi Sasya Shalini Desho Yam Kshobarahitaha Brahmana Santu Nirbhayaha Om Sarve Bhavantu Sukhinaha Sarve Santu Niramayaha Sarve Bhadrani Pashyantu Ma Kaschit Dukha Bhag Bhavet Asato Ma Sadgamaya Tamaso Ma Jyotir Gamaya Mrityorma Amritam Gamaya Om Purnamadav Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi Om. Question.
I do.
Oh, go ahead.
Bringing my mind back to my knowledge. I know, in a sense, that's what you talked about the whole time. But I'm wondering if we could laser in on what...
What that would mean?
Yeah.
Well, one way to think about it is when your mind is causing you pain, right? And it could be different, like agitation or distraction or discomfort. At that time, that's kind of like the mind raising its hand for some attention, right? And so the first thing is that it's given you a signal that something's bothering me, right? And so one thing you can do is when it gives that signal, you can just say, this is all part of bringing it back, what is it that's bothering me? You know, where you ask the mind, instead of looking out, this person's bothering me or that's bothering me. So you can do that also, just to know, to be clear about it. But what is really bothering me? And then because of all of your exposure to knowledge, you have different ways of talking about that. Like you could say, you know, I feel frustrated because this is not how I want it to be. Or whatever it is, you'll figure out something. Some way to talk about what it is that's bothering you. Okay? And so once you say what it is, you can handle that, you can deal with it objectively in a topical way. Like, I can do this and this and this to make it better. But that's objective. I don't need to be upset about that. Right? These are just certain things I can do to make the situation better. That's fine, that's objective. So then the question is, why am I agitated? Why am I so hurt about it? Why am I so angry about it? What is it that's really bothering me? And then you start to, that's what we call some, you know, there's some viveka. It's like you're starting to really bring your knowledge or your understanding to the problem. And once you bring your knowledge, your buddhi to the problem, then you can do the topical solutions, but then you can also look at it from a Vedantic perspective. You can look at it from the perspective of Antakarana Shuddhi. You can look at it from the perspective of Ishwara, or the perspective of Jiva Srishti versus Ishwara Srishti. From all of the different perspectives that we talk about, in order to see, you know, how is it really that you would like to respond to the situation? What is it that's really needed on an emotional level? That's bringing your mind back. Right? It's owning up the situation. Now, I think one thing that's really important there is recognizing that, I mean, the world has, our life has all kinds of bumps in it. It's not like everything is just flowing really smoothly. There's bumpy times and difficult times. But those times, all those difficult things, they have to be handled. They can be handled objectively. So we're not worried about that. We're not saying that everything's easy. It isn't. But I can handle it objectively. What I need to look at is the Jiva Srishti that's creating like a whole upset world around that. And that's what I can start bringing in. I can start, the Jiva Srishti is really a product of my Ajnanam. It's a product of projections. It's a product of hurts. It's a product of unconscious material that is running rampant. Otherwise, I can just be objective. So it's two phases. What we call in Karma Yoga, Kaushalam. Kaushalam means how to handle the situation. What is the best way, objectively, to handle the situation? To have that skill and be able to handle people properly, to be able to handle your work properly, all of these type of things, there's skill in that, just objectively. But then there's also my emotional self, you know, the Jiva Srishti, and all of the things that these different events tend to cause the mind to flare up in different ways, and that's where then I have to be with it, learn how to be with that. That's bringing my mind back to my knowledge. Now, it could be as simple as just seeing it and blowing it off. Remember, that's why I love that verse by Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita, where he says, you know, there's really three types of desires, raga dvesha. One is it rises in the mind. You can just blow it off like blowing smoke away. It's nothing, just, it's nothing.
Easy.
Because of your knowledge, it doesn't matter that much to you. It's just easy to let it go. Or any agitation, it's so easy, it's just like, let it go. The other one, next level, it takes a little more work. It's more like cleaning a mirror, a dirty mirror. You have to do some rubbing. You have to sit with it and work with it a while and be with it. And you have the skills to do that and bring yourself back to your knowledge, back to home base. The third one is like a fetus in a womb. And those are the bigger issues that we have. And those are the ones that I have to be patient. I have to do inner child work. Or I have to be able to sit with the hurt or the trauma for some time. Patient, I have to be patient. But I am being with it rather than projecting it out and attacking the world.
And rather also you're rejecting it too.
Yeah, that's being good. Also, you have the tendency to reject it. You know, like we tend to reject anything that shames us or things that we're afraid of. You know, it's hard to be with something that shames you or something that you feel fear. You have to learn one of the sadhanas that we've done that I think is a really beautiful one is the people that you want to push away or the situations that you're afraid of is to welcome them. Mm-hmm. To just sit there and imagine that person or that situation, whatever it is, and say, you can be with me.
I was with a cancer survivor a few days ago, and he was saying, and going through that experience, that the fear was 90% of the whole.
So much fear in him.
So is that the kind of thing?
Yeah, and imagine what it would be like to sit and welcome the fear. It's not easy to do, but it's huge. Welcome, and there's so many things also to welcoming the fear itself, but there's so many things that you are afraid of that you don't even realize you're afraid of them, but you try to keep them away.
Yeah.
You know, so many things. So to welcome those things, you can, like, I like the words, it's okay, you can be with me. You can be with me. And then to actually allow yourself to sit with that feeling or that emotion. Those emotions aren't going to kill you, you know. And when you don't push them away, they start to transform. It's a very beautiful process. But it's what's intuitive, what we call instinctual, is to push it away. And so that's normally what we do. And the more you push it away, the more tenacious it becomes.
I remember a while ago you talking about having like an experience or an emotion that was so strong that it was very difficult to like use logic or reason with it.
Yeah.
You kind of just have to like sit with it. And I remember you saying something like kind of like a fire burning. You kind of have to let that burn all the way out.
Yeah.
But
you sitting with it.
I guess I have this fear sometimes when I've sort of tried to do something like that, that you would get fixated on it, or that like that it's not going to.
Afraid it's not going to burn out.
And I still have experience where I kind of don't see it through to the end because I'm worried that I'm focusing my mind on it is not helping.
Well, there's two ways of focusing your mind. Like, say for instance, when you're, you're already consumed. So when I'm talking about when there's something that you're already consumed, so the fire's already there, you know? And so now, how are you going to be with that fire? Like, are you going to keep tending it, making it grow, you know? Or are you going to contain it? So say you allow yourself to be present to it is different than going along with it. I'm not talking about going along with it, but I'm also talking about not squelching it. I'm talking about really being present to it and even watching what images come up, everything. But I'm present to it. I'm not going along with it. I'm allowing it to be. In a way, I didn't use this word when I was talking about it before with you. I think I didn't say welcoming it. But being present to it is like that, and being very patient, because some hurts and betrayals and whatnot are huge, you know. And I can keep trying to push them away, but then I keep trying to push them away. It doesn't really work.
Well, can you be certain that if you don't push it away, that it'll unfold by itself, or do you have to do other things?
Well, you kind of have to get a knack for how to be with these different problems that we have. But the one specifically I was talking about is when something has really, really hurt you. It's big. And so you're carrying around inside a burning rage or hatred. It's big, not little. Big thing. You know? And then to say, okay. Then to sit there and be present to it. And maybe you sit there for 1 or 2 hours. And don't try to push it away. You're not engaged. You're not believing in it or wanting to become that. You know what I mean? But you're sitting there and being, allowing it and being present. And letting all of those feels be it. Let that fire burn. And it will burn out. That's different than acting out. Even it's not acting out even on a mental level. It's just not pushing it away and being able to have all of those feelings. Like when there's tremendous hatred and rage, you know, to be able to sit in the face of that, be present, and to hold it, to not push it away and let it do its thing, you know, there's something very, very healing about it, because you're not pushing it away and you're allowing it to burn itself out and do its thing. You're also present. The Atma is there. Your being is there. A similar thing, a little different, but if you've ever been hurt and just, for whatever it is, you just really cried your eyes out so that you're just awash, your whole body and mind are awash with tears. Mm. When that happens, if you let that happen, yourself is shining there in the middle of it. It's a very spiritual experience, actually. Yourself rises up. It's like the very beauty of your own being rises up in the midst of this huge washout of tears. And the same thing can happen if there's a huge, huge, all-consuming emotion that usually you're not sitting there with it. You're frantically, you know,
I gotta get out of here.
Doing things around it or thinking things, you know. You're not with it. But if you're with it, you know, it can burn out. It might not burn out. And the biggest one I ever had, I don't remember quite how old I was. I think it was 30 or something, somewhere in that. It didn't burn out in one day. It burned out in about 3 days. And that was probably about 6 hours of being with it. So it wasn't that I sat with it for 24 hours or something like that. But I'd say it was probably 6 hours. And that burnt out. It's like I couldn't keep it going anymore. I just couldn't. I was too tired. You know, it was over. But even then, that was a huge thing.
Were you trying to repair it all the time when this is going on?
Well, no, when that's going on, no, I was just allowing it to be. I just allowed it to be. But then to actually get to a place where I was totally okay, that took me 20 years.
Yeah.
But those 6 hours took away this all-consuming, you know, emotion. And then to have that not be kind of a something I had to deal with in my life, it took about 20 years to where I was bigger than that situation and really does not matter at all. And now, which 35 years later, it's a total non-issue. Mm. You know, but that's an example of the fetus in the womb. And that baby took a long time. that took a long time. That was a long incubation, not 9 months.
Yeah. Would it be fair to say, so what you're talking about now is like Antikara Nishuddhi.
It
seems like there's that, and then there's also this, the other thing you talked about answering my question of bringing the knowledge, you know, Ishwar or all that stuff.
Right.
Reminding ourselves of that. But you almost sometimes have to do the first one in order to even be able to.
That's right, but that's why we have to know all these things. Mm-hmm. You have to know how to bring your mind back and what's necessary. Like it might, what necessary might be not just something that takes 2 seconds. It might take more time and more work. But that's your work. That's your sadhana. That's what you do. Because you have enough knowledge and you have enough knowledge and enough of your own presence, enough mumukshutvam, for that to be the abhyasa. That's what you do until there's nothing, till that's not there to be done. When that's not there to be done, then you're just enjoying your knowledge.
So it's not a question of attaining high skills at this. You make it sound like the skills are kind of
already
in place.
Yeah, they're human skills. It's not brain science or whatever. You don't have to be a scientist or physicist or anything. These are just human capacities that you have to learn how to do. You know, in any human being who is here as a mumukshu, is listening to these classes, these things are not beyond anybody's capacity. They just have to be understood. And you can only do what you can do as you can do them. You know what I mean? It's like, but you have to know what to do. You have to know what the mind needs, what the different problems are, how to be with them. How to be with your mind in a caring way. What are the things that actually work, that actually help? What does the mind actually need? What are the tools? You know, and I have to be able, it takes a lot of courage sometimes to practice that, because sometimes you're going against what you want to do. Like this whole, for instance, this pretty picture bhavana, you know, where you're actually somebody that you feel animosity or hatred for or hurt or whatever, the last thing you want to do is go and talk to that person or offer them a flower. You don't want to do that because you have the opposite emotion. The opposite emotion is not interested in that. If the opposite emotion is what's there in your mind, then it doesn't want to go offer a flower. It has a different emotion. It has a different MO. And so the buddhi, you know, that's the, so the buddhi, your knowledge, has to take that manas, the manas is that it, holding that emotion, and it has to be able to say, let's try this. Like talking to a little child, we can do this. Yeah. And then you go do an action that is actually the opposite of what that emotion wants to do. And that neutralizes, that action is very powerful. It neutralizes that emotion, you know. But you have to have a commitment, right? You have to be a mumukshu. You have to have a commitment to antakarana shuddhi. You don't want your mind, you know, being controlling you in this way. You want to be the master of your mind. And that mastery is based in line with Dharma, in line with your knowledge. That takes some work. You know, one other thing. If you think of it also, like I'm sure Swamiji said something like this. You know, because he used to love tennis in the days of
McEnroe
and Jimmy Connors and all those guys. He loved tennis. He would never miss a game on TV. He loved it. But you know, to become a tennis player, to be able to make all those shots and do it, it takes years.
You start at 6 years old.
Yeah, but it takes years. It's not an easy to gain that type of mastery, you know. And to gain a mind, to gain a buddhi who that really knows, you know, based on your knowledge, knows how to handle all of these situations, has that kaushalam in reference to how to be with your mind in a way and to have the commitment and the strength to be with your mind, like a tennis player that has to go out and practice 4 hours a day or do so many things every day in order to be able to do that. For you to have kind of the strength and the commitment to actually work on these things that you would rather not. You would rather let those emotions run you. Your buddhi has to gain the strength to say, no, I want to run those emotions. I don't want those emotions to run me. It takes so much strength. But the more strength you have, the more strength you have, you know. And to have that strength, why do you have that strength? Well, because you're a mumukshu. That's why. You want to own up your knowledge, to own up what you know is true. And you don't want the mind with all its vagaries just to, you know, take you on a ride. Even Arjuna, I think it was in chapter 6 or somewhere in the Gita, he said to Krishna, you know, the mind is like a ship in a wild sea. How can I capture it? How can I handle it? How can I, you know, bring it back to shore safely? How can I do that?
What'd you tell him?
Well, the whole Bhagavad Gita keeps going around all of that, all of these sadhanas that we're talking about, and the knowledge, how the knowledge plays into that. Hmm. But a lot of it has to do with your commitment to do that versus that, as we'll see later, that tamas. Tamas is just going to bed, not dealing. That's tamas.
Isn't there also like a part of you that can kind of enjoy it? Like kind of get into the drama and
I think you can for a while. It depends on how bad it is.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. If you're enjoying it, it's not that bad.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. It's just drama. So it's kind of entertaining and all of that, but then you're not caught in it.
Not bothered.
Yeah, you're enjoying the drama, but that means you're not really...
I mean, even if you could see it as a drama, then you're not in that total
You're not totally gone.
You're not totally gone.
But there comes a time when the drama is bigger than you. You know, then that's not fun. You know, it's real. Then it's real, and you're really hurt, being hurt.
Being controlled by
the
drama.
Yeah.
I want to bring your mind back in you know, the Antakarnashuddhi and the Vedanta or the knowledge part. There's, I mean, just the Abhyasa is also, if we're students and we're, and that really helps. We come back, we listen to the teaching, we do Shravana, and the reeds get parted, you know, and there's a relief and a break and a chance. And when you're dealing with one of those fetus type things,
yeah,
you know, it's going to take some time. And that's, I guess, another part of the.
And that's another beautiful thing to know the truth of that and to learn the patience. Because if you have that patience toward yourself, you can have it toward other people also. Mm. You know, being patient is—it's a good quality. It's a good human quality to have. Everybody appreciates your patience, including you. Not everything changes all at once. You know, it's not instant. There's not instant gratification in a lot of these things. It takes time.
Also,
and commitment.
I mean, my mind's really happy to hear this. It really, I feel very pleased, you know, and relieved. But also, in the beginning of Vedanta, I remember that if the vision alone is enough to make you centered on yourself, and you don't, and if you get carried away by your mind, it means your vision is tilted, and that the work should be there.
Where?
With the vision, not mind care or emotional care.
Well, I think the two are going hand in hand. Getting clarity of knowledge is one thing, and knowing how to handle your mind in light of that knowledge, which is the whole karma yoga, really.
And that shouldn't be dismissed. I mean, that's something to...
You can't dismiss it.
You can't dismiss what, right?
Well, you can't say that working with your mind or karma yoga, you know, or antakarna shuddhi is as much part of this teaching as is jnanam. In fact, we have names for it. The means, what we call the upaya, the means for gaining self-knowledge, called upaya nishta, you know, that rootedness in the thing that is to be known. The means for the knowledge itself is shravana, manana, nididhyasana. That's how I gain this knowledge. But what about the antakarna shuddhi? That's called upaya nishta. The upaya means the vehicle that has to gain the knowledge. How do I prepare that? Right? And you don't come to this knowledge with the mind already totally prepared. That's kind of a, Swamiji calls it, that's a pipe dream. You know? You don't come with what we call this uttama adhikari. The uttama adhikari means the student who is uttama, supremely qualified student. The student is supremely qualified. The antakarna shuddhi is there. They just have to listen to it and it's over. Because there's no, the antakarna itself, the unconscious, all of these things are, there is no problem. They have dharma nishta. They don't have anything to work out. So their mind, all they have is ajnanam. So that's when they use the example for that of Shweta Ketu in the Chandogya Upanishad, chapter 6, where his father teaches him Tattvamasi 6 times. His mind was ready for it. You know?
But Swamiji hasn't met anyone like that after all these years.
No, he says there is no such thing now. That's not realistic. But that you're a mamukshu, that you're a madhyama or mandana adhikari, means that not the uttama adhikari, which was more or less non-existent at this point. You have the mamukshutvam, you have the qualifications to gain this knowledge because you're a mamukshu to enough degree to gain the knowledge, but then we have issues in our mind. Our mind has different hurts and it also has conditionings and ways of behaving in the world that produce pain and ways of having been treated at a young age that produce pain. So many different things. So now it doesn't stop you from gaining knowledge, but then that pola isn't there because the mind, you know, is in so much pain that so much of its time is only spent trying to heal itself from on a relative topical, in a relative way, you know. And so now it's very important to know, in the light of your knowledge, what is really healing for the mind? What will really take care of it? But that's very integrated into Vedanta, including now in this era, some psychological tools that we need. In this era, we need that. The whole world needs it because of too much adharma in the culture, in the society of the world, not just here. And so the mind doesn't have, it has some problems that we need to take care of and that we can take care of. So that's the Upayanishta. That's not separate. These two things go together like the Bhagavad Gita, remember? The Bhagavad Gita is honored as an Upanishad and it's also honored as a Yoga Shastra.
Wow.
The Yoga Shastra is Karma Yoga. So it's viewed as an Upanishad. We chant this at the end of every verse. It's viewed as an Upanishad. Means it gives Atmajnanam, it gives self-knowledge, and it also gives the means for gaining the Antakarana Shuddhi that is necessary. Even if you weren't gaining knowledge, your mind wants to be free of pain. And so that's why even people who are not mumukshus go to therapists. You know, they do all kinds of self-help courses and whatnot because they want a mind that enjoys at least relative shanti, relative well-being. And so Vedanta, the Upayanishta, Shravana Manana Nididhyasana, is really speaking to the mind that has that relative well-being, a mature mind. But the mumukshus that come need to gain that mature mind and gain this knowledge, so they both feed off of each other. The knowledge helps the mind become the mature. As the mind becomes mature, it helps the mind to understand the knowledge, so they're both working together.
So it's not just one thing, just no division and you're fine. It's two things here.
No division?
Yeah, no division, that's possible.
It's not just the vision
and you're fine.
It's not just the vision and you're fine if the mind has issues that need to be taken care of. Then those issues need to be taken care of, you know, because the mind won't rest until they are.
And everybody has issues, right?
Yeah. So like I said before, Swamiji's never met a student that just got it.
Swamiji said that's not possible. Nowadays. It's hard to imagine it, actually. I mean, maybe there's somebody could come along, their prior karmas, you know, their prior lifetimes and whatnot. They could come with a very, very, very high degree of Antakarana Shuddhi.
Yeah,
you know, that's certainly possible. It's unlikely, but it's possible. Mm-hmm. There's nothing wrong with that. It's fine. You know, but we have to work with the mind that we have, and we have to understand, you know, the different tools. Like, say your mind is, like, sometimes with one of the teachers that taught Swamiji and Sadhu, he was kind of a grouchy guy, you know, but it didn't seem to bother him. He was fine. He was ornery guy. But he didn't have a problem with himself. He was quite content, you know.
But did other people have problems with him, though?
I don't know. Not necessarily.
No.
I mean, maybe they did.
Probably would have.
Maybe. But that's not the point. The point is that is your mind and who you are, in terms of your mind, causing you pain? Does it hurt you? Is your mind hurting you?
So it doesn't matter whether the guy is being adharmic or by his agitations or not. The guy's being adharmic, grouchy guy.
No.
Well, he could be grouchy and not be adharmic.
Yeah.
If you're adharmic, then I think that there's... That creates a different type of issues.
That's a different ballgame.
Yeah.
Grouchy is not being adharmic?
No, not really.
Do you like people being grouchy in your face? I don't.
I wasn't talking about it as being a dharma. Let's forget this one. I don't know quite how to answer you on it.
Yeah.
I wasn't equating with a cantankerous person.
Yeah,
know,
that's what I mean. Yeah,
but
like
for me, I wouldn't. I could enjoy a cantankerous person.
You could.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't.
Yeah. But then that's an issue for you then, because you can't accommodate a cantankerous person.
So I have to work on my psychology then.
Yeah, you might be able to learn to.
But hopefully, I have the vision too at the same time.
Yeah.
Although, Peter has a point. Then their words are not necessarily pleasing. You know that whole thing, whatever. Hitam, shriyam. I forgot.
Well, we're taking it too far.
Okay.
You know, like say you're saying, I wasn't looking at cantankerous quite that way. I mean, I thought I saw this teacher as kind of gruff. I never met him, of course. This was before my time. But in my imagination, he was, you know, kind of gruff in a way, but it didn't make me think that he was adharmic or mean or something like that. I wasn't thinking about him like that.
Isn't that kind of a tradition in some lineages that the teachers...
It could be, but that wasn't even the point that I was making. We're taking it way too far.
Yeah, I think you better stop.
Let's stop.
Nisargadatta, though, if you watch a video of him, he's pretty intense. I don't think it would bother me, though.
You throw people out of the
word.
Yes.
But... You have to, I don't know, we're getting off the mark. I'm going to say one more thing, though, and it's going to be the last word.
The last word?
Go ahead.
I think you're better off learning how to kind of appreciate all the different kinds of people and enjoy them for what they are, instead of getting negatively engaged with them, you know? It's nice. I mean, I've seen Swamiji for so many years, so many different, thousands and thousands, literally, of people he's engaging with, and all different types of people, all different types. And he's just interested in them for who they are. He doesn't need them to be a particular way. And that gives those people, maybe other people can't tolerate those people because they want them to be this way or that way, but he really doesn't. He's just kind of present to who you actually are, and he doesn't feel threatened by you. And that gives the other people a lot of space, and it also gives you a lot of space to just to abide. You know?
Well, so if he'll tolerate them, he can tolerate me. I mean...
Yeah. But that being able to kind of abide, you know, gives you a lot of freedom too. And then say you can't, say you're not able to abide that person. To me, that's a sadhana. You know, like what is really being triggered in me that won't let me accommodate this person. And accommodate, I don't mean that, okay, this is fine. I'm not trying to whitewash anything, but why is my Shanti being disturbed by the way this person is? Anyway.
I'm sitting in a cafe today, and school got let out, and I was, you know, suddenly all these teenagers are showing up, and they're all swearing left and right. I mean,
that's what they did.
And it bothered me, and I was asking myself, why am I even noticing?
Well, you might not.
To me, but I hadn't been around teenagers in a long time, for one thing.
Yeah.
It was something I wasn't used to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, anyway.
Does Timmy have a new box father? She was just in there.
Okay, everybody. Good night.